It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today, I'm going to begin with a little story about Layman Pang and his daughter, Li Cao. Discern, if you can, how the point of this story relates to the point of Dogen's Kanshi for today. It's a test. Okay, so here's the story about Layman Pang. It's P-A-N-G. Layman Pang. When Layman Pang was about to die, he said to his daughter, Li Cao, "Go look at the sun and see what time it is. Just when it's noon, come and tell me." So Li Cao went to the door and looked out and said, "The sun has just reached noon, but there's an eclipse." When Layman Pang went to the door and looked out, Li Cao went to her father's seat, placed her hands together, and passed away. Layman Pang smiled and said, "My daughter's deafness," D-E-F-T-N-E-S, deafness. Then he postponed his departure from the world by 7 days. The governor of Xingzhou, came to visit Pang Yun and asked about his illness. Layman Pang said to him, "I ask you that you regard everything that is as empty, nor give substance to that which has none. Farewell. The world is like reflections and echoes." Then, placing his head on the governor's knee, Layman Pang passed away. His cremated remains were cast on rivers and lakes. Monks and laity mourned him, saying that he was actually Vimalakirti. 300 of Layman Pang's poems were left to spread through the world. And Vimalakirti, a rich adherent of the Buddha, lived in the midst of second century courtly life or worldly life. But even though he lived in a very much worldly life, he was he tread the bodhisattva path. So he was in his very beloved because of his stress on the equality of lay life and monastic life. He successfully challenged many of the great ones on Buddhist points, some of their talks back and forth, challenging each other, are very funny, actually. Zen holds his sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, in particularly high regard. I think Robert Thurman has translated it, and people seeing the equality of Layman Pang with Vimalakirti says a lot about their deep respect for Layman Pang. So the kanji for today is called snow. The five petal flower opens, a six petals added. That's a snowflake. Though daytime with blue sky, it's as if there were no light. If someone asks what color I see, these are Gotama's old eyes. I'll read it again. The five-petal flower opens, a six petals added, which means a snowflake. Though daytime with blue sky, it's as if there were no light. If someone asks what color I see, these are Gotama's old eyes. So Okamura Roshi tells us that the five-petal flower is a plum blossom, the first flower that opens in early spring. And its blossoms are beloved because they bloom in winter snow and radiate this very subtle elegance, which is a symbol of many things: perseverance, hope, purity, beauty, the brevity of life. So because a snow crystal is hexagonal, in Chinese literature, snow is sometimes called a six-petal flower. So this line describes the scenery of midwinter to spring. The entire earth is covered with snow, but plum blossoms, the earliest flower, are already blooming on the branch. Still, it's continually snowing on the blossoms. So the blossoms are there, but it's still snowing. And even though it's a fine day with blue sky, when it begins to snow, the brightness of the sky disappears, and you know that it's a still cold and gloomy winter. In the phrase, it's as if there were no light. No light can also mean lacking wisdom or ignorance. Even though the flower of Buddha's awakening is already open through our practice, we still feel we're in the darkness of ignorance. We still experience the unsatisfactory nature of everyday reality. In the lines, if someone asks what color I see, these are Gotama's old eyes. Old eyes and color have a relationship with each other. Color is the object of eyes. And I'd like to explain further the idea of color being the object of eye, a sense organ, which sees the object. Recently, we've talked about the eight levels of consciousness that keep us recycling through samsara. And so basically, we've learned that the first five are the five sense organs, or the five sense consciousnesses. The sixth is our ordinary mind. The seventh is manas, the ego-centered mind that clings to the idea of I and sees everything in a self-centered way. And the eighth is alaya, the storehouse of seeds of every single action we've taken in this lifetime. And usually our focus is on manas, our ego-centered mind, and alaya, our storehouse of seeds. But I want to be sure you understand the others, the first five and the sixth, and how they work together. So what does the phrase, the five sense consciousnesses, mean? The five sense consciousnesses are the consciousnesses that arise when one of our sense organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and skin, meets with an object. So, for example, the eye sense organ meets with an object, a plum blossom. And then a consciousness is established registering this event. So the same with the ear sense organ meeting a sound, and our nose sense organ meeting a smell, a tongue sense organ, a taste, and a skin sense organ touching something. The encounter of the organ with its sense, with its object, eye plum blossom, creates its own consciousness. And it's these sense consciousnesses, by discriminating between likes and dislikes, good and bad, and so forth, that go on to develop craving and clinging, etc., that leads us, it keeps us recycling through birth, old age, and death, which are at the end of the chain. Okay, so we've got the first five sense consciousnesses, and there's a sense object, there's a sense, there's the organ, and there's what the organ senses, and then there's the consciousness that's built from that encounter. The ordinary mind, the sixth sense consciousness, behaves similarly, and it's also it's often lumped in with the other five, which is so then the ordinary mind is lumped in with the other five sense consciousnesses, and they're called the 18 sense consciousnesses because there's three things attached to each of the six. So we've got the five sense organs, the mind, and each have an object, themselves, a subject, themselves, an object, like eye sense organ, EYE, plum blossom, consciousness made out of that. Those three things times six sense organs makes 18. And then the seventh, manas, our ego consciousness, and the eight, alaya, they make the eight, the eight consciousness, levels of consciousness that end up keeping us cycling and recycling through suffering lifetime after suffering lifetime. In Shakyamuni Buddha's time, most of his disciples studied, that is, in their Zazen practice, their practice, their meditation practice, was on either the Four Noble Truths, which, as you recall, is life is suffering, suffering has causes, suffering can cease, and here's the pathway for suffering to cease, the Eightfold Noble Path. So that's one, the Four Noble, those are the Four Noble Truths, and that's one of the great teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, and many of his disciples spent their entire meditation life studying the Four Noble Truths, meditating in meditation, deeply understanding and achieving fundamental insight from this way of practice. The second, so that was one main way of practice. The second main way of practice was called the 12 Nidanas. Those who contemplated the chain, this is the chain of dependent origination, in both the forward and back, there are 12 of them, 12 links in the chain. And the disciples of the Buddha meditated on these 12 links in the forward direction and a backward direction, and achieved a fundamental insight of what the Buddha taught from his night of awakening. About this chain, the Buddha said, when this is present, that comes to be. What from this arising, that arises. When this is absent, this does not come to be. From this cessation, that ceases. So everything is interconnected. And the notion of causality of suffering is described as a sequence of 12 interconnected links, nidanas, that are often called the 12-fold chain. So I'm going to tell you the 12-fold chain, but please understand this is what came from Buddha sitting all night and then attaining awakening with the morning star, seeing the morning star. So this is not like philosophy. This is like Buddha's actual experience, and this is what he understood from his experience, he saw how this chain reaction, starting with one, ignorance, and ending with death, kept us recycling again and again, and suffering lifetime after lifetime. So the 12 are ignorance. And ignorance doesn't mean ignorance of book literature. It means ignorance of, let's say, that life and death are the same thing. So ignorance of the true nature of reality, put it that way. Predispositions are the second. If you sort of imagine an infant, this chain will make a little bit more sense. So ignorance of the nature of reality, and then predispositions, and then consciousness, and then name and form, kind of sense of oneself, the six internal sense bases that we just went over. And then the next four are the big four. This is where we really trap ourselves. So the next one is sensory contact, making sensory contact with another object. Then having sensation or feeling. Then attachment for that thing, thirst or attachment for that thing. Then grasping or clinging is the ninth one. The tenth is the process of becoming. I just imagine it. In the womb, just imagine that, although there's many other processes of becoming. And then birth is the 11th, and old age and death are the 12th, accompanied by sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So 6 to 9, sensory contact, feeling or sensation, attachment, and then clinging or grasping, are definitely the four we need to focus on. But these 12 are interconnected and happen like the Buddha describes. When this is present, that comes to be. From the arising of this, that arises. And this is how we cycle and recycle ourselves through life after suffering lifetime. So Dogen says that the color he is seeing is Buddha's eyes. Rujing, Dogen's teacher, says that when Shakyamuni Buddha attained awakening while sitting under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha lost his eyes. That is, when he saw the reality of no self, the dichotomy between subject eyes and object bright star dropped off. Thus, he found interdependent origination with all beings. That is the meaning of the famous expression, I together with the great earth and all beings simultaneously attain the way. These were the words the Buddha spoke upon awakening. This idea, when Shakyamuni attained awakening, he lost his eyes. You could almost say that awakening is losing one's eyes. By losing the separation between subject and object, he saw beyond the normal kind of seeing into seeing reality as it is. In Buddhism, it is thought that our mind and our sense consciousnesses that create those are the things that create the dichotomies that prevent us from seeing oneness, the true reality of all beings, which is called interconnectedness, are the merging of differences and oneness, requiring the necessity for non-discrimination. So Dogen's expression of dropping off body and mind during Zazen means having a direct personal experience of this. In the Kanchi snow, the words Gotama's old eyes refer to the Buddha having this experience of non-discrimination. Everything is one. So if you were one of his monks hearing this poem in the morning's Dharma Hall discourse, you would later on only have to recall the phrase, Gotama's old eyes, to remind yourself of probably the most fundamental truth in all of Buddhism, the truth of our interdependent origination with all beings. So regarding the lines, if someone asks what color I see, these are Gotama's old eyes, it means these eyes don't see the color. These eyes don't see color. These eyes are like Gotama's that see beyond color of any object. So that's what Dogen was saying. These eyes don't see color. They're just like Gotama's old eyes that see beyond subject and object into seeing the reality of all beings. Suzuki Roshi made this point in a number of different ways. First, he said, wherever you are one with the clouds and one with the sun and the stars that you see. Even if you jump out of an airplane, you don't go anywhere else. You are still one with everything. That is more true than I can say, and more true than you can hear. That is more true than I can say, and more true than you can hear. That's Suzuki Roshi about the oneness with all beings, that we're just all one thing. And it reminds me, this idea of this is more true than I can say and that you can hear, reminds me of a teaching I heard about faith in Buddhism. And so apparently it's held in Buddhism that there's only two kinds of faith. And one is you have evidence, but you don't know. And the other is you don't know altogether. And so the first is like you're digging a well, you're digging for a well, and you dig and dig, and pretty soon the soil gets wet, and you dig and dig and dig, and then the soil gets more wet. And at that point, you don't know, but there's evidence that you'll be able to get your well. That's the first kind of faith. There's evidence, but you don't know. And the second kind of faith is that you absolutely don't know. So all you can do is have faith. And there's a very famous story about this kind of faith that I want to share with you, because it's, you'll never forget it. And it's a perfect example of just pure faith. And I don't remember the details, so I may have the details wrong, but the essence is not wrong. So let's see. It takes place in India, this story, and an old woman is concerned, I think, about where she goes after she dies. And she asks her son, who travels for his business, to bring her a relic from a certain saint that she can use for her prayers. And the son agrees, but he keeps forgetting. So she asks him again, and he forgets. She asks him again, and he forgets. And finally, she pleads with him, please don't forget this time. Please don't forget. So he goes off with it firmly in his mind, but on his way back, he realizes that he's forgotten again. But on the road, there was this dog that was dead, and it had been run over, and it was on its side lying in the gutter. And he thought, I'll just take a tooth from this dog's mouth and she'll never know the difference. So the woman indeed was thrilled. She cleaned it and polished it and put it on her altar. And every day she prayed to it. And her faith was so pure that there were many signs, even her leaving her own relics, that her fervent prayers had been answered. and her son was stunned and ashamed, and from then on became very religious. Again, I don't, the details may be wrong, but this is a great story about just pure faith. The second of Suzuki Roshi's points is that it is just your mind that says you're here, that you're here and I'm there, whatever. That's all. Originally, we're one with everything. If someone dies, you may say he is no more, but is it possible for someone to vanish completely? That is not possible, and it is not possible for something to appear all of a sudden from nothing. Something that is here cannot vanish completely. It can change its form. That's all. So we are always one. And third, this is not actually on the subject, but I can't resist throwing it in anyway. This is another Suzuki Roshi point. You think that you can only establish true practice after you attain enlightenment, but this is not so. True practice is established in delusion, in frustration. If you make some mistake, that is where to establish your practice. There is no other place for you to establish your practice. I have a few other poems by Dogen that are, there's no problem in understanding them, and they're very lovely. The first one is called On a Snowy Night in Spring. Although I cannot help but be upset by the peach and plum blossoms covered by snow and frost, I admire how pines and bamboos watch the dreamlike passage of time without regrets. You may not be able to tell it from my old hair and skin, but I am unshaken, having given up fame and fortune for so many years. And this one is called On Hearing a Spring Thunderstorm in Kamakura, third month, 1248. For 6 months, I've been taking my rice at the home of a layman, feeling like the blossoms of an old plum tree covered by the snow and frost. Exhilarated in hearing the first sound of thunder crackling across the sky, the five red petals of spring peach blossoms will soon be brightening the capital. And the last one is called Ju Qing told the assembly of monks at the time of the autumn moon. Clouds are scattered in the autumn sky, but you can see the moon in your mind. I raise my hoshu and say, look. That's all. And I'll read a few of my own kanji also. The first one is called Stones Are Lean, Mahogany, and Nanmu Trees Are Strong. Basho, as he lay dying, took his poems for worthless. This was not just posturing. Words, he felt, who cares? Yet each day I sweep my room, arrange my pencils carefully, seeing them all lined up so simply. And the second one. Knowing that friends are coming, I use my foot to clean around the wicker gate. Why complain of loneliness and seclusion when a hermit's life is what you seek? Sparrows frolic, roosters crow, so what? To be one of a tribe of mountain birds floating by a cliff, you needn't be a mountain bird. I think that's one of my favorites. I love that poem. And then the third one, a long and firm sweet flag comes from yesterday's festivities. Snow hisses down, my fire sputters. Jonathan died last May. He was 24, you say. A shower of sleet bashes against the glass. A green moon slowly rises. Caw, caw, caw. One black crow dominates the northern river. So here are some of the important points. First, wherever you are one with the clouds and one with the sun and the stars that you see. Even if you jump out of the airplane, you don't go anywhere else. You are still one with everything. That's an easy one to remember. Even if you jump out of an airplane, you're still one with everything. The second one is, it's just your mind that says you are here and I am there. That's all. It's just your mind. It's just your mind. You're here and I'm there, but actually we're all one. So our mind really, really gets in the way. Third, Rujing, that's Dogen's teacher, Rujing says that when Shakyamuni Buddha attained awakening, while sitting under the Bodhi tree, he lost his eyes. That is, when he saw the reality of no self, that this self that we value so much has no inherent independent existence. That's called no self. When he saw that in his meditation, the dichotomy between subject eyes and object bright star was dropped off. So he lost the dichotomy and he found interdependent origination with all beings, the oneness. That is the meaning of his famous statement, I, together with the great earth and all beings, simultaneously attain the way. Simultaneously. So when Shakyamuni Buddha attained awakening, all beings along with him attained awakening. It's an amazing statement because we're part of all beings. Fourth, it is held that there are two kinds of faith in Buddhism. The first is where you have evidence, but you don't know for sure. And the second is when you don't know, period. I think that's really interesting. And fifth, in the 12 interconnected links of causation of suffering of life, link 6 to 9, that is sensory contact, feeling or sensation, attachment and then clinging or grasping are the four most important for us, because we do it all the time. You know, we do it all the time. We feel something, or you see a person you're attracted to, and then there's feeling or sensation, and there's attachment, and then there's clinging or grasping. And then there's a couple of more links that come after that, ending with birth, with old age, sickness, and death. And then the sixth point from today, true practice is established in delusion and in frustration. If you make some mistake, that is where you establish your practice. There is no other place for you to establish your practice. Because that's the present moment for you. You make a mistake, that's your present moment. So you don't have anything else. All you have is, I just made a mistake. That's it. So here are some ideas for reflection during the week. First, what is the teaching point of the story I told you at the beginning of our talk about Layman Pang and his daughter, Ling Cao? Second, explain in your own words the meaning of the phrase, Gotama's old eyes, and its significance in Buddhism. Third, write down, for the sake of your own memory, the eight levels of consciousness. Just note them down, because it's easy to forget them. And fourth, of the two kinds of faith, you don't know but there's evidence, or you don't know, which do you see in yourself? You see both, but maybe one more than the other. Think about this and give an example of both, if you do both, how it's played out in your past. Or if you're a person who scorns faith, say why. Why do you scorn faith? That's the fourth question and the fourth thing to think about this week. And the fifth, an important implication of Dogen's poetic phrase, Gotama's old eyes, is non-discrimination between life and death, for example, or likes and dislikes, good and bad, right and wrong, this kind of thinking. And so how are you doing in this department? It can be useful to take non-discrimination as a practice, and as you go through your day and catch yourself discriminating, stop and consciously point this out to yourself. You just liked something and disliked something, or you just made a discriminating thought about somebody that you saw on the street or whatever. And tell yourself to practice non-discrimination instead. Just stop and say, non-discrimination, non-discrimination. Just as a way of beginning to weaken that part of your eight levels of consciousness, just as a beginning. Those actions are coming from the seventh consciousness, the ego-centered consciousness. Oh, I like this, you know, who cares about that, like that. And it's really important to work on these. So I wonder if there are questions.
So the first comment that we got was when you recited the poems, we got a comment from someone saying beautiful poems and with the heart emoji. Then we have a question. What is the teaching point of the story you told at the beginning of our talk today about Leman Pang and his daughter Ling Zhao?
So the teaching point for the day, as you know, I'm trying in at least in this series, and I may continue because I think it's a good idea to have one main point for the whole talk. And then you remember this one main point, and that I think that'll simplify everything. And the teaching point for today when Dogen uses the phrase dropping off body and mind during Zazen, he means dropping off our discriminating mind so that we can realize the oneness of all beings. So it's about our discriminating mind, which sees likes and dislikes. We have opinions. We have prejudices, we have racism, we have the whole thing. And so, but originally we're one with everything. And like Suzuki Roshi said, it's not possible for someone to just disappear. And it's not possible for someone to just come from nowhere or any being, not just people, but anything. There's always a cause and condition for every single thing. And all we can do is change the form. We can't disappear altogether. So we're always one. And the enlightened minds of both Leman Pang and his daughter, Ling Zhao, they just take this truth for granted. They don't even think about it. Of course, that's how things are. And so death is nothing because we're not going anywhere. And when we see the ease at which enlightened beings lack discrimination, even between life and death, it's easy to see how much work there is left for us to do. So the teaching point of this story is non-discrimination about life and death. They totally had it. You know, they definitely were awakened ones. And the point of our talk today is also dropping off our duality, our mind of duality of subject and object, to get beyond that, to being able to see, actually experience in our Zazen, actually experience the oneness of all beings. So that's how the teaching point of the Leman Pang story relates to the kanji for today. It's all about, in a way you could say, non-discrimination. You could just say that, non-discrimination between life and death, you know, oranges and apples, whatever, it doesn't matter, anything. I love that little story because I think it really shows non-discrimination. And we discriminate so much. I gave you that exercise to do because I've been doing it myself since January. And it really has helped, this non-discrimination exercise. When I catch myself making a discrimination, I stop and I point that out to myself that I'm making a discrimination. And then tell myself not to make a discrimination. And I think it's been helpful. I think that's softened a little bit. That's why I suggest that you do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another question that we got is, I understand the logic of the statement. When the Buddha attained enlightenment, all beings did so as well, since all are one. But we are still in delusion. How is it explained that we are all one, but still separate? How does the enlightenment of an individual affect everyone else, aside from by their actions after enlightenment?
Yes. You'll be maybe pleased, I hope, to know that this was Dogen's burning question all his life until he met his teacher, Ruijing. So he, you know, if we're already enlightened, why should we practice? That was Dogen's burning question. And in Japan, he scoured Mount Hiei, I don't know how to pronounce that word, but that mountain that had all of the main monasteries on it. So he scoured all the territory for teachers who could answer that question, and he found no one. Well, he actually did find one teacher, but he still had that question. So he, with that one teacher, Mio Zen, traveled to China to see if they could find a teacher who could answer that question. And Dogen spent 4 years altogether in China, and he met his teacher at the very end, Ruijing. He met him at the very end. He was newly appointed abbot to a monastery Dogen had already visited and dismissed the value of the abbot there. So when he met Ruijing, that was it for him. And he learned that when we do zazen, we are expressing our enlightenment. We aren't trying to get enlightenment. We are expressing the enlightenment that we already have. And the reason for practice is to practice the strength of who, practice strengthening that part of ourselves. In other words, it's lying dormant there. We all do have that, actually. And it's completely lying dormant, and it doesn't appear when we behave in an enlightened way, enlightenment appears. And so we do, I don't want to use the word have, because it makes it duet. I have this, so that's not really true. But enlightenment enlightens itself in this being when we practice in the spirit of enlightenment. So when Dogen drops off body and mind in his zazen, he expresses the full and complete awakening that he already has. And even in our kind of what we always think of as lame zazen, even so, since, thank goodness, we don't do zazen, zazen does zazen, there is also the enactment of that same thing. That's why zazen is so important, because in those moments where we are doing zazen, we are expressing our awakening, the awakening that because we're a being, we got, language doesn't express this. So I'm using words, and you can quibble about the words, but you have to go beyond the words of just knowing that when Buddha said, I, along with all beings in the whole earth, attain awakening, however that sentence goes, it does include us, but we can't just sit there. We have to practice to, it doesn't activate until we activate it. That's the bottom line. So enlightenment is not like this thing. It's within action that it expresses itself. And when Zazen does Zazen using our body, this is expressed, and we can get stronger and stronger in that. I hope that answers your question. You should be proud to have that question, because it was Dogen's burning question. And it makes sense. It's an important question. But actually, enlightenment is already, just as the Buddha said, within us. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. We just got another question, a very short question. So somebody asked, does practice feel like suffering?
It's not practice that feels like suffering. It's our habits and our stuckness. And so when we intend to do something, and it isn't only Zazen, try it, just try it out, make any intention, and immediately the world floods in with obstacles. Just make any intention. I remember when I started my writing practice, and I actually wrote this in a book. Every single day, there was a really important reason why I shouldn't do it. Every single day. It was amazing. I mean, I started to laugh, actually. So I always did my writing practice. But I just started laughing at how, oh my God, here's another one. If I don't do this, like right now, something bad is going to happen. And I'm just not going to do it anyway. And so, like, forget it. But try it. Try making an intention. And the intention is, So when you sit Zazen, you make an intention to sit Zazen, and there's all this aches and pains, and no, I don't want to do it, and I really need to do this other thing, and all of that, it all comes from causes and conditions that we ourselves have laid down to prevent awakening. You know, we are really entrenched with these eight levels of consciousness. That's really who we are. That's why I'm talking about it a lot these days. We're stuck there. And especially the seventh level, the ego consciousness. And the ego consciousness feeds on the alaya, and it's supported by the other seven or six consciousnesses. We've got a lot going against us. That's why they're suffering. But Zazen itself isn't suffering. It's what we've already laid down as causes and conditions for this to be painful and hard. But really, almost any intention you make will end up being painful and hard. And really, I invite you to try it out. Thank you. Thank you for asking that. I think everybody has that question. I guess one more thing to say is when you do it anyway, there's a real strength that comes with doing it anyway, and it's called willpower, and you need to build willpower. And I think I've told many people individually, but I'm going to say this to everyone listening. Around, it's very important to build willpower, and you do it by making an intention and keeping your intention no matter what. And the bad point is that when you make an intention and you keep your intention, you build willpower, when you make an intention and you don't keep your intention, you lose willpower. You don't just say the same, you lose willpower. So it's very important when you make intentions to keep intentions. And I think you can, if you're just starting out practicing building willpower, you can use things that you already know you're going to do. Like you already know you're going to go to the drugstore later today. So you can say, I'm going to make an intention to go to the drugstore today. And then you go to the drugstore. So then you've built willpower. So you can start by doing things you already know you're going to do, to make that and set an intention to do it then, and then do it. And then you've built willpower. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question we have is, why did Layman Tang call his daughter Daft?
Because she was. She knew exactly what he wanted to do. So he was ill. That's why the governor came to visit him. He was ill, and she figured that he was going to just die. And so why not? And enlightened beings, we've seen this before. Many examples of enlightened beings who actually they show off sometimes their power to know when they're going to die and the circumstances under which they're going to die. And so Layman Pang and his daughter were both enlightened. And so she knew that when he asked her to go and see when it was noon exactly, that's when he had planned to die then. So she sent something that brought him to the door instead of on his seat. And she went to a seat and died herself. She passed away. And so then he came back and she had already like occupied his seat. So then he said, my daughter's deafness. He didn't say, oh, my daughter, she's dead now. What am I going to do? He didn't say that. He said, my daughter's deafness. She beat me to it. And then he had to put his death off for a week. But then after the week, he also died when he planned to die. So remember the there was a great being who it said he died standing on his head. So they just play with this. I mean, not every awakened person plays with it, but when one is awakened, one knows about the circumstances of one's death. And he called her deaf because she was deaf. I think I need to stop now. And before I do, I want to thank all of you for being here, for which I'm very grateful. And also I'm grateful to my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, for making all of this possible. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.